Hello, one and all, to another episode of Deep Lore. Today, we are going to be discussing a relatively old conspiracy from the 1960s that many of the classic conspiracy theorists cite when discussing perpetual conflicts, shady government dealings, and even the existence of aliens. However, it has certainly lost its high regard in this new occurrence of neo-conspiracy theorists in the past 10 years, the report from Iron Mountain. As you can see by the conspiracy iceberg I am currently using, this is ranked as a Tier 5 conspiracy. The Report from Iron Mountain is a book published in 1967 by the Dial Press. It is written and presents itself as a report containing a bibliography from a government organization consisting of 15 men in a special study group. These men were from many different occupations, however all of them were from academic or STEM backgrounds. The names of these 15 men are kept anonymous throughout the report and are only given simple alphabetical names for convenience during meetings. Examples of these are Arthur Abel, Bernard Baker, and Charles Cox. The meetings would act as a backdrop to assess what would happen if the United States entered everlasting peace. The group would meet in various locations around the United States to discuss this hypothetical question. The most prominent place these meetings would be held was in an underground nuclear bunker aptly named Iron Mountain. The foreword of this book provides a brief history of one of these men, named John Doe to keep anonymity, approaching the author, who is named as Leonard Lewin in the book, but we'll get back to that later, to make a public report from Iron Mountain. The foreword also references the government's attempted suppression of far less controversial reports than the report from Iron Mountain, such as the Gaver Report and the Monaghan Report, all suppressed with the intention of curbing communism. The foreword is then ended with a statement from John Doe, explaining that he believed the public had a right to the information and that this was his prime reason to release the report. After the foreword, but before the report proper, there is a series of question and answers with John Doe to learn more about what would happen during these meetings. John Doe begins by explaining that the first concept of this group was originally created by the Kennedy administration and was further developed after the Cuban Missile Crisis early in 1963 and began in August of the same year. John Doe notes that in his belief that while the report from the Iron Mountain was a government-funded group, the project was given to an outside agency to avoid government red tape and constraints. John notes that many government operations were not subtle, often putting operation in front of a seemingly random word which would just invoke suspicion in the public if they were to find out. During the project, the 15 men were just named the Special Study Group. John and the other members would often jokingly call themselves the Iron Mountain Boys. It was also believed that when the study group first started, the president himself did not know of the existence. The group would meet around once a month, mostly on weekends for a period of 2 days. Sometimes the meetings would be longer, and only one lasted 4 hours. During these meetings, they would play peace games. John notes that these games didn't follow the typical usage of the word game, but instead was carried out by a program on a computer. In summary, peace games were a program with the ability to interlace two seemingly irrelevant occurrences and determine the outcome. For example, how a change in the college entrance requirements in the United States would impact the British shipping industry. The peace games would provide the group with an exact outcome of these events, allowing them to determine if one should go ahead. John stated that the report itself was written as a collaboration between all 15 members of the group. After all the question and answers finish, the report is then shown. The main body of the report contains 30 pages, which is far more than I can explain to you in a video like this. However, to summarise, Section 1 first introduces a study group and states the three non-exhaustive criteria that the group will govern their deliberations around. Section 2 discusses disarmament and the economy. It's no doubt that the sale of weapons and ammunition is a considerable budget for any government to foot. The report from the Iron Mountain states that the industry accounts for 1/10 of the output of the world's total economy, with the United States spending upwards of $60 billion a year. The report also discusses the impact on the manufacturers of ammunition, from the CEO to the common factory line worker. The problems posed in Section 2 are concluded in the report, stating, quote, "No proposed program for economic conversion to disarmament sufficiently takes into account the unique magnitude of the required adjustments it would entail," end quote, ending with, no serious consideration has been given in any proposed plan to the fundamental non-military functions of war in a modern society. In summary, the business was so vast there is no economic relief available to the country if peace were to be established. Section 3 proposes a scenario if disarmament was to take place, following the Reed, that's R-E-A-D, model, which consists of a 12-year plan to reduce the number of weapons. Needless to say, the report deems that no major power can proceed with the Reed model until the financial issues is first solved. Section 4 is titled War and Peace as Social Systems, and focuses on society as a whole if peace was achieved. During this section, the Iron Mountain Boys make clear that the assumption that war is subordinate to the social systems it is believed to serve, in their belief, is entirely false. The group go as far as to say that war itself is a social system that humanity has lived under for most of its history. The removal of war isn't the purification of a social system, but would be the shift of a social system into another, namely, peace. The group summarises Section 4 by stating that the economic systems serve the war system and not vice versa, and war is needed to keep the social system running. In Section 5, the Iron Mountain Boys assess the functions of war in a variety of sectors: economic, political, sociological, ecological, and cultural. Far too long for me to explain in detail. I would recommend you read it yourself, but the group determines that in all of these sectors, war comes out as beneficial. One of the most interesting sections is Section 6. If you don't want to read any of this book, just read this part. Essentially, this section discusses substitutes that would have to be established to replace the functions of war, which includes accounting for the usual deaths that would no longer occur from war by paying what the Iron Mountain Boys describe as a blood sacrifice. This may include increasing speed limits in cities to increase deaths, or incorporating modern slavery. This section also notes that an extraterrestrial police force should be used to maintain order on a higher level. The overall conclusion of the report from Iron Mountain made by the study group is that war is indeed needed for the government to maintain power. In the event that the United States entered into lasting peace, there would need to be some shocking substitutes put in place to hold power over the citizens, concluding that the easier option would be just to continue creating wars. The group had their last meeting in March of 1966, where a debate was hosted regarding whether the public should know of the report, or whether it should remain secret. The majority of the men in the study group agreed that it should remain secret, more so out of fear from the public than anyone else. After this debate, the group was disbanded. Not much is noted as to what happened to the rest of the members after the meeting stopped. However, John learned that two of the members suffered heart attacks briefly after, which he believed was due to the emotional and harrowing nature of the report. So, now that the summary of the book is done, we can talk about the fallout of the book release and the peak in conspiracy theorists' attention. The US News and World Report claimed in its 20th of November 1967 issue that an unnamed government official confirmed the reality of the report, in addition to stating that when President Johnson read the report, he hit the roof and ordered it to be suppressed for all time. Furthermore, it was said that orders were sent to US embassies instructing them to emphasize that the book had no relation to government policy. Now, modern prints of this book will say that Leonard Lewin was the writer, as he himself stated it was an act of fiction in 1972. However, this is rejected by conspiracy theorists as a simple scapegoat for the government and as a poor attempt of damage control. To add to this conspiracy, the book was reviewed in 1967 by someone called Herschel McLandris, who vouched for the authenticity, stating that he was invited to participate in the creation of the report, and while he was unable to be part of the study group, he was consulted from time to time regarding the writing of the report. He also stated he was to keep the report secret. Herschel McLandris was supposedly the pen name for a Professor John Kenneth Galbraith, someone who fit the criteria for a member of the study group, or at the very least, an advisor. Interviews with Professor Galbraith did not aid any results, where he would either be incredibly defensive when questioned about the authenticity of the book, or seemingly joking about his part within the report. In 2015, in a publication called The Nation, Viktor Navsky, asserted his involvement within creating the report from the Iron Mountain and named Leonard Lewin as the main writer with input from John Kenneth Galbraith. This is still firmly believed by some of the older conspiracy theorists as a means of damage control, and they still vouch for the authenticity of the report. Unfortunately, there's not really much else that could either prove or disprove this conspiracy, and it's highly dependent on whether the person reviewing the conspiracy believes that the author, or supposed author, Leonard Lewin, was a scapegoat. It's kind of left the report from Iron Mountain in a kind of stasis, where no matter how much the supposed authors would state that they had involvement into it, if the conspiracy theorists believe it enough, they will believe it's some sort of damage control. Furthermore, any attempts to prove that Iron Mountain is actually a government document and did happen would be shot down by people who believe that the author has made themselves known. I'd love for you to let me know whether you believe it is a real conspiracy theory or simply a satirical hoax to show how gullible some people can be. Thank you very much for watching this episode of Deep Lore. I hope you learnt something today. If you liked it, leave a like, and if you want, subscribe. I'd greatly appreciate it. We're going to be descending the conspiracy iceberg, and I'd love for you to come along with me.